Mrs. Dalloway. Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself, for Lucy had more than enough to do. The doors would be taken off for the party. Rumpelmeyer's men were coming to do it. And then, thought Clarissa Dalloway, what a morning, fresh as if presented to children on a beach. What fun, what a plunge, for that's how it had always seemed to her when she had thrown open the French windows at Boughton and plunged into the open air. There it was stiller, quieter than this, of course. How fresh, how calm the air was in the early morning, like the kiss of a wave, cool and sharp. And yet it was solemn, for a girl of 18, as she had then been, standing there and feeling that something awful was about to happen. She was looking at the flowers, at the trees with smoke rising through them, at the birds rising and falling. She was standing and looking until Peter Walsh said, "Daydreaming among the vegetables?" Was that it? Or did he say, "I prefer men to cauliflowers"? Was that what he said? He must have said it early one morning when she had gone out into the garden. Peter Walsh. He would be back from India soon, June or July, she forgot which, for his letters were awfully dull. It was his sayings that one remembered, and his eyes, his pocket knife, his smile, his moods. And how strange it was, when millions of things had disappeared, to remember a few sayings like this about cabbages. She paused at the edge of the pavement, waiting for a van to pass. A charming woman, her neighbour, Scrope Purvis, thought her, knowing her as one knows the people who live next door in Westminster. She was like a bird, blue-green, light, full of life. Though she was over 50, and he noticed that her hair had turned very white since her illness. There she stood, waiting to cross, perfectly upright, never seeing him. Having lived in Westminster so long, was it 20 years now or more? Clarissa felt the beat of calm, a pause, but that might be her heart, affected by influenza, the doctors had told her, before Big Ben sounded. There! First a warning, musical, then the hour, final. We are such fools, she thought, crossing Victoria Street, for loving life so much. These crowds, this noise, this movement. Carriages, motor cars, vans, bands playing in the parks, and the strange high singing of some aeroplane up above. That was what she loved. Life, London, this moment of June. For it was the middle of June. The war was over, except for someone like Lady Bexborough, who had opened a church fete, they said, with the telegram in her hand. John, her favourite, was killed. But it was over, thank heaven. It was over. It was June. The King and the Queen were at Buckingham Palace, and everywhere, though it was still so early, there was a stirring of life, wrapped in the soft, grey-blue morning air. And she, too, loving it as she did, was a part of it. For that very night, she was going to light a spark to give her party. But how strange the silence was on entering St. James's Park, the mist on the lake, the slow-swimming happy ducks. And there, coming along on some important business, handsome, manly, almost too perfectly dressed, was her old friend Hugh Whitbread, the admirable Hugh. "Good morning to you, Clarissa," announced Hugh, rather extravagantly, since they had known each other as children. "Where are you going?" "I love walking in London," said Mrs. Dalloway. "Really, it's better than walking in the country." Hugh and Evelyn were in London, unfortunately, to see doctors. Clarissa could not count the time she had visited Evelyn Whitbread in hospital. Was Evelyn ill again? She was not at all her usual self, Hugh told her, not needing to say more, for Clarissa understood at once in her sisterly way. At the same moment, she felt oddly aware of her hat. Perhaps it was not right for the early morning. Was that it? For Hugh always made her feel like a girl of 18 as he moved on, raising his own hat rather extravagantly and promising to come to her party. He might be only a little late after the garden party at Buckingham Palace. But she always felt attached to him, having known him so long, and thought him a good man in his way, though Richard was nearly driven mad by him. As for Peter Walsh, he had never to this day forgiven her for liking Hugh. She could remember scene after scene at Boughton, quarrelling with Peter. Hugh was never Peter's equal, of course, but was not such a fool as Peter believed. When Hugh's old mother wanted him, he went, without a word, unselfishly. Peter would say that Hugh had no heart, no brain, nothing but the manners of an English gentleman. But that was just her dear Peter at his worst. He could be impossible, unbearable, but wonderful to walk with on a morning in June like this. For she and Peter could be parted for hundreds of years. She never wrote him a letter, and his was so dull. But suddenly she would wonder, if he were with me now, what would he say? He would not notice the beautiful day, the trees and the grass, and the little girl in pink. Peter never saw a thing of all that. It was the state of the world that interested him, and the failings of her own character. How they quarrelled! He said she would marry a prime minister and stand at the top of her stairs, greeting her guests, and be the perfect hostess. She had cried over that in her bedroom. So she would find herself in St. James's Park, still arguing with herself that she had been right not to marry him. For in marriage, there must be a little independence between people living together every day in the same house, which Richard gave her and she gave him. Where was Richard this morning, for example? At some government meeting? But she never asked what. But with Peter, everything had to be shared, and it was unbearable. When it came to that scene in the garden by the fountain, she had to break with him, or they would both have been destroyed. Though she had felt the pain for years, like an arrow in her heart. Then there had been the horror of hearing at a concert that he had married a woman he met on the boat going to India. Never would she forget all that. Cold and heartless, he had called her. She would never understand how he cared, he said, and there was no need for her to waste her pity. He did not need it. He was perfectly happy, though he had never done anything they talked of. His whole life had been a failure. It made her angry still. She had reached the park gates. She stood for a moment, looking at the buses in Piccadilly. She would not say of anyone in the world now that they were this or were that. She felt very young, at the same time incredibly old. She had a lasting feeling, as she watched the taxicabs, of being far, far out to sea and alone. A feeling that it was very, very dangerous to live even one day. Not that she thought herself clever or anything but ordinary. She knew nothing. No languages, no history. She hardly ever read a book except in bed. Yet she was completely fascinated by all this life passing before her. And she would not say of Peter or of herself, "I am this, I am that." Her only gift was knowing at once what people were like, she thought, walking on. She remembered the house at Boughton, full of people, lit up for parties at night. She remembered her sister Sylvia and Sally Seton, such crowds of people dancing all night. But everyone remembered. What she loved was this, here, now, in front of her, the fat lady in the cab. Did it matter then, she asked herself, walking towards Bond Street, that one day all this must go on without her? Did she mind? Or was it comforting to believe that death was an end? But still she believed that here, there, in the streets of London, somehow she survived. Peter survived. She was part of the trees at home, of the house there, of the people she had never met, laid out like a mist between the people she knew best. Her life, herself, spread far. But what past was she dreaming of as she looked into the bookshop window, reading Shakespeare's poem about death in the open book? Fear no more the heat of the sun. Death was an end to all fear and joy. This recent age had been for them all a fountain of tears. They had met suffering with courage, been upright. Think of the woman she admired most, Lady Bexborough, opening the fate with the telegram in her hand. There were so many books spread open, but none that seemed right to take to Evelyn Whitbread in hospital. There was nothing that would make that dried-up little woman look pleased, just for a moment, as Clarissa came in. How much she wanted people to look pleased as she came in, Clarissa thought. And she turned and walked back towards Bond Street, annoyed. For it was silly to have other reasons for doing things. She would much rather have been like Richard, who did things simply because he wanted to. Instead, she thought, waiting to cross the street, half the time she did things to make people think this or that. Oh, if she could have had her life over again, she thought, stepping onto the pavement, if she could have even looked different. She would have been dark, like Lady Bexborough, with tough skin and beautiful eyes, slow and splendid, rather large, interested in politics like a man, very sincere. Instead, she had a narrow stick-like body and a silly little face like a bird's, even if it was true that she carried herself well. But now this body that she wore, with all it could do, seemed nothing at all. She had the oddest feeling of being unseen, unknown. There would be no more marrying, no more having children now. There was only this extraordinary and rather solemn progress with the rest of them, up Bond Street. This being Mrs. Dalloway, not even Clarissa anymore. This being Mrs. Richard Dalloway. Bond Street fascinated her with its flags flying, its quiet shops, nothing extravagant. There, a roll of cloth where her father had bought his suits for 50 years. There, some necklaces. There, a fish on a bed of ice. "That is all," she said, looking at the fish shop. "That is all," she repeated, pausing for a moment at the window of a glove shop where, before the war, you could buy almost perfect gloves. She took such pleasure in gloves, but her own daughter, Elizabeth, did not care for them one bit. "Not one bit," she thought, going up Bond Street to a shop where they kept flowers for her when she gave a party. Elizabeth really cared for her dog, most of all. Still, that was better than sitting in an airless bedroom with Miss Kilman praying. It might just be something, as Richard said, that all girls go through. It might be falling in love. But why with Miss Kilman? She had been badly treated during the war, of course, losing her job, and one pitied her for that. And Richard said she was very clever, had a great mind. But Elizabeth, her own daughter, was always with her. And Miss Kilman did not care a bit how she dressed or how she treated people who came to lunch. She cared greatly about the state of the Russians and the Austrians, but in private caused such pain, being so uncaring, dressed every day of the year in the same old green raincoat. She was never in the room for 5 minutes without making you feel how superior she was, how inferior you were, how poor she was, how rich you were. It was not really her that one hated, but the idea of her, which had probably turned into something that was not Miss Kilman, a monster to battle in the night. Maybe, in another world, she would have loved Miss Kilman, but not in this world. No. It hurt her, though, to have this monster stirring within her, never to feel quite happy, quite safe. For at any moment, the hatred would stir and had the power, especially since her influenza, to give her actual pain. It shook all pleasure in beauty, in friendship, in being well, in being loved, in making her home lovely, as if a monster were trying to dig it up by the roots. As if happiness were nothing but self-love. Nonsense, she cried to herself, pushing through the doors of Mulberry's flower shop. She advanced, light, tall, very upright, to be greeted by Miss Pym, whose hands were always bright red, as if they had been plunged in cold water with the flowers. There were flowers of all colours, snowy white, palest blue, dark red, deep orange. She breathed in the earthy, garden-sweet smell as she stood talking to Miss Pym, who thought her kind. For Mrs. Dalloway had been kind years ago, very kind. But she looked older this year, turning her head from side to side among the roses, smelling them with her eyes half closed. She went from jar to jar with Miss Pym, choosing. Nonsense, nonsense, she said to herself, more and more gently, as if this beauty, this smell, this colour, and Miss Pym liking her were a wave rolling over her, defeating that hatred and lifting her up when, oh, a gunshot in the street outside. Oh dear, those car engines, said Miss Pym, going to the window to look, smiling and apologising, as if the noise of those car engines were all her fault. The violent explosion that made Mrs. Dalloway jump came from a grey car which had stopped outside Mulberry's window. People outside on the pavement, who stopped and stared, had just enough time to see a face of the very greatest importance inside, against the pale grey cloth, before a hand pulled down a grey blind. Word travelled quickly up and down Bond Street, like a silent mist, touching the street with its quiet, solemn mystery. But nobody knew whose face had been seen. Was it the Prince of Wales's, the Queen's, the Prime Minister's? Whose face was it? Nobody knew. A man said, "The Prime Minister's car!"